Hello and welcome to Pulsar Space Impulse's very own podcast on everything spacey. I'm Ria Urban, your host for today.
Welcome everyone to the very first episode of Pulsar Space Impulse's very new and very own podcast. Our very first guest is Zaria Serfontaine, who has a bunch of work titles, job titles. One of them is the Bid and Mission Concepts Engineer at Astroscale. She is also the co-founder of Frontier Space Technologies, and she's the chair of UKSEDS, the UK Students for the Exploration and Development of Space. Welcome, Zaria.
Thank you very much for having me, Ria.
Right. So can you just walk us through your life and introduce yourself to our listeners? Just tell us where you come from, where you are now, and basically start with your childhood.
Excellent. Well, that's a lot to cover. I'll try and make it like a bite-sized piece. I'm originally South African. I was born in South Africa. I lived there for about 12 years before moving over to Ireland. So the accent makes absolutely no sense. There's no trying to decipher it. I think growing up, I don't think I realized that space existed. South Africa is kind of very focused on South Africa because there's a lot going on there. So it's not really the land of opportunity, things like that. So, you know, as far forward as I could think, it was just basically, you know, I want to go to university. That was kind of the furthest that I thought ahead. When I moved to Ireland, there was a few more opportunities, but I also went to an all-girls Catholic secondary school. Wow. So some of my choices were things like home economics or art or music. So not really the you know, the engineering, technical drawing things that I might have been interested in, but it was still good. And I ended up choosing, in Ireland, it's a kind of a strange system. You have to do English, Irish, maths, and a foreign language for your school subjects. And then you get to pick three extra. So I did physics, art, and geography. Just to show you how confused I was at that point of what I actually wanted to do.
I understand.
And actually, I did much better in Irish than I did in maths. I did so poorly in maths, in fact, that I had to do a special exam over the summer to even get into my university course to be able to study engineering. So on paper, it did not look like I was an engineer. But in my head, I knew what I wanted to do was engineering. I wanted to build things, fix things, take things apart, learn how they work, things like that.
Okay. So just for our listeners, I know that you have a bachelor's in engineering in aeronautical engineering. You have a master's in astronautics and space engineering. And you are currently doing a PhD in aerospace, aeronautical, and astronautical space engineering. So, wow, going from Irish to engineering, yeah,
that's a step. It's a bit of a leap. It's a bit of a leap. There's still a lot of ways to be creative in engineering. So I think the art and the Irish and German and all of that still helped.
Okay, and how did your teachers and your family react when you said that, okay, well, I'm actually better at this, but I want to do that?
It was a hard sell. My parents are, my mom studied psychology and she became a teacher, and my dad is a horticulturist, so he runs a garden center. So no technically inclined people in the family, really. And me being the oldest as well. My sister also studied engineering, but she's younger, so because she came next, it was a little bit more de-risked, let's say. But it was interesting because like I said, all of the questionnaires that I filled in, I had career guidance counselor at the schools, you know, they were kind of saying, okay, it's great that you're passionate about this, but, you know, on paper, maybe we should look at other things. Like, my mom kept trying to suggest jobs that were still technical, but a little bit more artsy. So she was like, oh, but what about graphic design? You know, graphic design, you still get to work at a computer, you know, you still get to do all the technology things, but it's a little bit more creative and things like that. So yeah, it was a little bit of a hard sell, but I think my parents were fine as long as I could convince them you could get a job afterwards. As someone from South Africa, that's like the number one thing that gets drilled into you from a very young age is, doesn't matter where you go, doesn't matter what you study, you need to be employable. I think the moving over to UK and doing the master's in space engineering was actually a bit of a harder sell, because I could convince them that aeronautical engineering was still just engineering, and they know that engineers get paid well and, you know, have job security and all those things. But when I told them, okay, I'm going to save up money for 2 years and then just move over to the UK, stop everything for a year, and then study this very, very specific course, and then hope I can find a job afterwards, that was harder. Yeah.
Okay. Wow. Well done. That's amazing. Right. And after your master's, you chose to go for a PhD.
I chose over the course of a year to go for a PhD. So I moved over, did the space engineering master's, and then, you know, was completely thrown into this whole new world of space. I did my first week, we studied astrodynamics. And I had this stupid idea that it was going to be any way, shape, or form similar to aerodynamics, where, like, you know, astrodynamics, aerodynamics, they must be connected somehow. Completely wrong, but, you know, completely just so much new information to take in. Yeah, so much to do. And then after that year, it was like, okay, what's next? You know, do I get a job? Do I study more? Do I go back into aerospace? And what had happened was I could only find a job in aerospace. Like, I could only find a job in these aerospace roles where they couldn't guarantee you that you're going to work in the space sector. You know, you might end up working in aviation, you might end up working on transport, things like that. And that's not what I studied my master's for. You know, I really, really just wanted to work in the space sector. So it was a lot of going back and forth on, like, if I do a PhD, am I, like, overqualified for some of the jobs that I want? You know, will I be able to go back into industry? If I don't do that and I take an aerospace job, am I going to get stuck in a certain sector and not be able to transition over? So I had, like, a gap year almost where I was a research assistant for a few months, and that kind of gave me time to figure out what to do next. But the opportunity for the PhD was that my supervisor was the same supervisor for my master's. She is amazing, so supportive, and she helped me kind of create the PhD that I wanted to do. And I kind of saw it just as 3 years of me building up all those skills that I didn't have at that point that meant that I wasn't getting jobs that I wanted. So I had, like, a mental list of, like, picking up systems engineering and testing and all of these kind of things over 3 years, and then, you know, eventually ending up hopefully where I wanted to be.
That's great. You mentioned something that's very important. So in the UK, a lot of the, well, not just in the UK, in every country, I imagine, a lot of space-related jobs are strictly connected to the RAF, so the Royal Air Force. So you can get certain jobs unless you're a UK citizen, or unless you've been in the country for at least 5 years, so they can do all the background checks. Was that the case with you? Have you had any trouble getting a job because of that, because you haven't been in the country for long enough?
So I think that would have been the case if I was South African, 100%, because I saw so many of my friends who studied masters, you know, have to move abroad because they just can't get jobs in the UK because of that reason. Because the UK invaded Ireland a number of times and did very bad things to us, it means that a lot of the legislation around, like, being able to work in different countries and stuff like that, Irish people get, like, a certain exemption to that. So luckily for me, it meant that because I had my Irish passport, I could work here without having to jump through all those hoops. But there are a lot of hoops, right? Especially, like you said, because of how close it's linked to the defense sector.
Right. Okay, let me ask about your jobs then. So first of all, you're a chair of UKSETS, which I'm a member of as well. So what do you do there? What does UKSETS do, and what do you do?
Too much. We do too much. No. So UKSETS, SETS is this global organization, Students for the Exploration and Development of Space, and there's different chapters in different countries. The UK happens to be one of the oldest ones because we've been around for about 35 years. And then the other ones are, you know, there's one in the US that's very active, SETS Italy is very active. I think we're the only ones that swap it. Normally it's like SED US, SEDS Italy, SEDS everything.
But we have to be different.
Like, we have to be different. So where you guys said so it runs off, it rolls off the tongue a little bit better. But yeah, the organization, we're about a week away from our biggest event of the year, which is the National Student Space Conference. That's where we bring about 500 students together to just network with everybody in the space sector, do workshops, go to panels, socials, everything like that. We also run a lot of different competitions to help students get the skills that they need to get into the space sector, because we're kind of that point bridging people, students, to the actual space sector. And what we hear a lot from industry is, you know, the students don't have the right skills to enter the space sector. They don't have the practical skills they need. They have theory, but they haven't applied it. And from students, we hear the same. We're like, we hear there's just no opportunities to actually get hands-on with a lot of these projects. So we try to get them to design and build rovers, rockets, satellites, you know, just very low risk. You know, you can make a lot of mistakes, and then you can, if it blows up in the end, it's fine. but yeah, basically we run a lot of those events. We also have spacecareers.uk, where you can learn all about careers in the space sector. That's going through a major redevelopment at the moment, so we're trying to make it a bit more sustainable and a bit more professional. Then yeah, and apart from that, there's just so many other small things that we get involved with as well. We just try to be kind of the voice for the students amongst industry, and we try to make sure that any opportunity that the industry has, we're flowing back down to students.
So the conference that you mentioned, NSSC 23, that's going to be in Manchester between the 4th and 5th of March, is that right? And it's at the University of Manchester. So if people want to meet you, they can go there and meet you there.
Yeah, definitely. I might be running around like a headless chicken with a folder in my arms, but it's fine.
It's fine, yeah. Right, so you said you do everything as chair there. What does your work involve?
So at EKZs, we have about, it fluctuates a lot, but we have between 50 and 100 very active volunteers. So these volunteers are the ones that do a lot of the real work. They're the ones that put together the competitions, that put together the events, that, you know, help us write papers about the sector, anything like that, anything, everything. And they're kind of split into different teams. So we have outreach, we have diversity, we have competitions, we have membership, anything like that. And then every year we elect an executive committee that is made up of 6 members, and they're the ones legally responsible for the charity, and they're the ones also a bit more focused on long-term strategy. Although it's difficult as 6 students to decide what the future long-term strategy of the charity should be. But it's basically just taking a longer view on what EKZs could be doing and building up a lot of those kind of industry connections as well.
Right. I think that's a good opportunity as well to really get started and, you know, do your networking, meet industry, and also academics as well. Cool. And then you went on and became the co-founder of Frontier Space Technologies. How did that happen, and what does Frontier Space do?
So Frontier Space is interesting because I think if you talk to anybody that knew me a few years ago, I would say that I'm not sure what I want to do for a career, but the one thing I'm very sure of is I never want to have my own business. You know, that was the one thing that I always told everybody, don't want to have my own business. Too much work, you know, you're not able to shut off, that's the one thing I don't want to do. But when I was doing my PhD, I was working on a device that's going to help satellites deorbit a bit quicker. So it's one of those kind of clean space initiatives. And there's a product there that, as an academic, as a PhD student, I was just finding incredibly hard to actually give to people. It was a case of, you know, I know this technology exists. I know it can help a lot of people be more sustainable. I have a way to make it really cheap. I have a way to make it really adaptable to different satellites. But just the physical act of actually being able to commercialize it just wouldn't be possible without having like an entity to sell it. So the opportunity came along where there was already 3 co-founders of Frontier Space Technologies who were spinning out technologies out of Cranford University, and they had invited me to join. So I think at the moment we've shifted focus a little bit, so we're not so much on the drag sails anymore. They still exist if you want them, but we're more focused on this miniaturized lab that we're sending to space so you can do microgravity experiments in space.
Right, that's cool. Going back to the drag sails, so space sustainability is a big thing. It's very important, but I recently read some articles where the industry was trying to downplay how big the problem is. How big the problem of space debris is, according to you?
Ooh, if only I had the answer to that question. It was when I was first introduced to space sustainability and space debris and all of that, it was a half an hour session as part of one module as part of my master's, where the lecturer was telling us that, you know, these pieces of debris traveling at 7.8 kilometers a second, you know, causing chaos, you know, this is happening. It's going to get worse. We haven't fixed it yet. And then they just moved on to the next topic. They were just like, right. Okay, yeah, now we have to go with propulsion. You know, it's, yeah. it was, and for me, that just stuck in my brain. I was like, wait, no, this seems to be the most important thing to focus on right now. Why aren't we talking more about this? And I think the difficulty is there's so many variables when it comes to space. It is the models that we currently have to predict how much space debris is up there, to predict how much worse it's going to get, to, you know, to even track pieces of debris. We're just not there. We can't. We don't have an accurate estimate of what's up there. We don't have an accurate estimate of how much worse it's going to get. And because of that, it's really, really difficult to get that sense of urgency across, because even if it's the case that, you know, it's not going to be an incredibly huge catastrophe within the next 10 years, if we don't start fixing it now, it's going to not be possible to stop it at all. So exactly. It's that kind of, yeah, feeling. But it's difficult, especially because space sector is developing, so there's a lot more industry now. There's a lot more new players. And when you're thinking about business, you need to think about profitability. So
of course,
you know, it's difficult. But yeah, it's I think I'm like neutral about it, because it's we're seeing it pop up a lot more at conferences. We're seeing a lot more of the larger organizations, like the UK Space Agency, for example, wanting to be world leaders in it. But it's still treated as like a side topic. You know, it's like, oh, okay, we're having a conference, we should have the topic on sustainability. It's not at the forefront as much as it should be.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, well, part of the problem is that so low Earth orbit is congested already, and we sent up 1,700 satellites last year. We're going to send up a lot more this year, but the satellites are getting smaller, so they argue that that's going to be better. And low Earth orbit is not just, you know, one orbit. It's a lot of orbits. So yeah, it's a difficult thing, and because there's a lack of legislation, and companies are shifting the blame here and there, it's a hard, very hard topic. But yeah, I think something must be done before the situation gets as bad as, for example, you know, the case of oceans here on Earth and polluting the oceans. So we shouldn't wait until then. And already there are instances when these satellites or space debris crash into the International Space Station. We're going to have a lot more space stations up there. And then when these satellites crash into each other or into anything else, they can fragment to even smaller pieces. So yeah, we definitely need drag sails and companies who help deorbit these. That's a great idea. Okay. And you also work for Astroscale, and Astroscale is trying to do something similar, deorbit satellites in a different way. Can you tell us how you landed the job and what you do there?
Yeah. So yeah, I think just to speak to what you said before as well, I think space debris, like I said before, it's so complicated. It's so complicated to model and all of that, but it's also so complicated to fix. So I think there's so many different facets to it. One of them is, like you mentioned, fixing the regulation to make sure that, you know, people comply to things. The other one is trying to fix what's already broken up there, so trying to bring down some of the debris, which is what Astroscale does. Some of it is trying to prevent future debris when we're sending objects up. I think my the worst phrase that we always hear is people saying, well, space is big, you know. That's because the probability of things hitting at the moment is low. So yeah.
Sorry, I have to say that there's a certain South African person who actually said that, and his name is Elon Musk. He said space was big enough, there's no problem.
We can't just have non-controversial people, you know?
Yes.
South Africans have to just be that little bit controversial.
Yes, and space is big, so he didn't lie. Space is really big.
Yeah, but it's such a frustrating sentiment. It's like, for geostationary satellites that are further away, you don't necessarily have to deorbit them, but you have to put them at your graveyard orbit. And a graveyard orbit basically just means that we can guarantee 100% for the next 100 years, it's not going to come back down to Earth.
Right.
What happens after that? Exactly. What happens after the 100 years? It might still come crashing down. So we still need to fix it. That's one of the many things that Astroscale is working on. So Astroscale is looking to do a bunch of different things, but mostly focus on like active debris removal. So being able to remove satellites from orbit or being able to remove pieces of junk from orbit. And then, you know, all the kind of adjacent sectors that include as well. So things like looking at refueling or things like looking at being able to swap out modules of satellites and make them live longer, anything like that, anything to do with in orbit servicing. I actually got the job because I, through UKSEDS, I think, partially because of, you know, I qualified for it, but I think mostly because of networking. One of the trustees at UKSEDS works at Astroscale, so I was able to talk to him a lot about it, talk to him about different roles, saw him at different conferences. I'm sure he put in a good word for me as well, which goes a long way. I think it's getting better, but I think the space sector is quite, you know, still growing, still developing. So the more people you know, and the more people who know of you, the easier it is to get in.
Yeah, definitely. Right. And what do you do as bid and mission concepts manager there? Engineer, sorry, not manager, engineer.
Yes. So that is, it sounds like a made up title. I'm still figuring it out. I've only been there for about a month now. So
you don't have a job description?
The basic idea of it
okay.
is that I'm an engineer, but yeah. I'm working on the business development team. So okay. we're still at Astroscale, you know, still technically kind of a startup. You know, we're making a lot of money, but we're still technically a startup. So we have to still apply for a lot of these government bids and these larger bids. And to be able to do that, we need to convince them that we have a really good product. And there's a lot of technical work that goes into putting in a proposal, we're putting in a bid, and you know the engineers are focused on actually building the next satellite and building the next piece of equipment that we have. So what I do is I work with the engineering team, I work with the business development team, and I'm almost like that bridge between the two, and I put together a proposal to hopefully further the company.
That's cool. There are a few more companies who do similar things to Astroscale. I just wanted to ask about this. So do you feel that they're like a real competition, or do you feel that you can work together because there aren't enough companies concentrating on deorbiting satellites, so you can work together to achieve the goal of clearing low Earth orbit, or is it like a competition?
It's a bit of a competition because the funding available for things like sustainability is a bit low. So I think there is always that little bit of a competitive side, you know, you want to win the bid. But as we saw with companies like SpaceForge, where for the longest time, if you said that you want to manufacture things in space and then bring it back down, people would just laugh at you. They'd be like, there's no way, that's way too expensive. And then SpaceForge allowed, like, burned a path for that and allowed that to become, you know, a reasonable option. And now there's all the other companies popping up that are going to try it too. You know, it's a similar situation with active removal, where there's so many different ways you could approach it, but you just need a few companies first to be able to say, hey, this is not just like a pipe dream. It also makes business sense. It makes financial sense. It makes legal sense, you know, to be able to do all of that. And I think they're very, very different. I mean, once we actually remove the first piece of debris from orbit, that's going to be a huge day. But yeah. It's going to be so different every other mission that we do. Like, it's, yeah.
Definitely.
Like, think about what we tried before with, like, harpoons and nets and lasers and arms and just everything, yeah.
Yeah, I get that. Right, so bids aside, do you think we need more companies like Astroscale to solve the problem?
Yes, I do. I also think we need more companies that are able to survive, I guess. Because I think a lot of the even my own startup, a lot of the startups in the space sector join create a startup because they're passionate about space and they have this cool idea that they really want to do. But maybe it's me becoming more and more cynical, but it's really hard to do that without money.
True.
It's very difficult. Space is very expensive. So as much as I don't love business, because it's, you know, it's very hard numbers, it's very salesperson-y.
Hard numbers, you're an engineer.
I know. But I like my engineering numbers. I don't like negotiations. I don't like having to sell things.
Okay.
But it's important. It's so important to be able to actually get to that point where you can then save humanity, or, you know, clean up space, or do all of those things. Yeah, the business case.
Right. What do you think the solution in the long run is to space debris problem? Because currently there are guidelines which you either follow or you don't, so they can't really reinforce them. There are companies who are sending up satellites to very low Earth orbit, so eventually they're going to come back down to Earth and burn up in the atmosphere, so that's one thing. Obviously, we can try and capture the space debris, but there are millions of pieces of space debris that we can't even track because they're so small. So what do you think the long-term solution is? And I agree with the notion that everything that goes up has to come down.
Yes.
You say that.
The answer, unfortunately, is all of the above. But okay. to take that apart a little bit more, yes, there's regulations. Regulations are still incredibly important, but to be able to implement them at an international level, which is needed because space is so international, it takes a very long time. And that's why things like the 25-year rule, where you have to do orbit within 25 years after end of life, that's why that hasn't been shortened yet, because it's just very, very difficult for every spacefaring nation in the world to agree that, okay, this is going to be the new number. But it's still important. So it's still important for the UN and global space agencies to work together to implement that. So that's one side. The other side is that the new space, so the space companies that aren't part of agencies that are using this for commercial benefit, they're growing a lot quicker than space agencies are. So those like 1,700 satellites that you said were launched last year, probably like 80%, if not more, of them were commercial satellites. You know, they're starting to, they need to make a profit. So for that, you know, introducing stricter guidelines isn't necessarily going to work. It's more about getting across the idea that it's beneficial for the companies themselves to have a cleaner space environment, because we're doing a lot of studies on to show that, like, to be able to avoid debris is costly, because you have to, you know, move your satellite out of the way. You have to use propulsion. Propulsion is mass. Mass is expensive. Yeah. You know, it's expensive to live in an environment that's polluted, and you're at risk. You know, your satellite that you spent years developing, you know, building, launching, all of those costs, it could just be gone in an instant. So for that, it's more about business practices. So it's about making sure that the new players in the space sector understand that, like, it's beneficial to them to be more sustainable. So that's kind of like the agency side. We still need the regulation side. We still need the business side. We still need to clean up what's there currently, because that's also going to keep getting worse. So that's the active debris removal side. But it's difficult to know, because it's all of these things together. And then on top of that, that there's a layer of us just not knowing what's out there. Like that's still really to be developed, because there's all this talk about space traffic management, which is basically setting up basically rules of the road. You know, it's like trying to, it's a motorway up there, but there's no lanes. So we're just trying to put in lanes, we're trying to put in rules, things like that. But it's hard to do that if we don't know where the things are for that. So those things. And then yes, the best thing we can do is remove things from space. And at the moment, the best way to do that is by deorbiting. But a very recent paper that may or may not be discussed at the next National Student Space Conference is suggesting that the burn-up is also changing the composition of the atmosphere. And that is actually making it harder for things to deorbit. So as much as, you know, the idea of let's burn things up so that we can get rid of the junk in space because that's safer for space, it's going to make it harder long term to be able to deorbit things.
Right. Okay. And capturing everything with a net and just throwing it in outer space wouldn't be a viable solution. I've been asked that question before. Or why
the thing
don't
is, like, we did a competition where we asked kids how they would clean up space, and that was a suggestion. Or you know, using lasers to make it explode, creating a black hole next to the Earth, and then trying to get the black hole to suck space.
Maybe not. So,
maybe not. But there's no such thing as a dumb idea in space. We did fund a mission that shot a harpoon at a piece of debris to try and deorbit it, and we have considered lasers. And there are ideas that sound completely insane. There are still nets being suggested as well, because different, very high-tech nets, but nets nonetheless.
Yeah, and it's been suggested that all that debris would have to go to the moon. And then when we finally colonize the moon, we can use those pieces to build whatever we need to build.
Or maybe do that in low Earth orbit, have like a recycling center.
Yeah.
Orbiting the Earth.
Yeah. Well, the ISS is going to be decommissioned soon, so we can have another space debris recycling center in place of that. Right. Okay. So let's just say that satellites are needed. So all these companies are not just greedy and they want to make money. Satellites are needed in our everyday life as well. So it's a good thing that there are satellites up there and that they're trying to send new generations of satellites into low Earth orbit to help us, because we use them for Earth observation. So they're very important in climate change monitoring, for example, in our banking systems, the GPS that we use. So we do need satellites. It's just what we do with them. And you mentioned the 25-year rule. So I think the US changed that to 5, starting a few years from now. It's going to go down to 5, but I'm not sure any other countries will implement that. But the US definitely changed that to 5, which is an amazing thing. But it still doesn't solve the problem of the debris that's already up there. There's one more thing I want to ask you about. Have you heard of Astriagraph or Privateer Space?
Yeah.
Right. So they have a map of the sky, essentially, and all the satellites that are up there. And I've seen these maps and they're amazing. It's amazing how many things are up there. But as I said, they can't track anything below 10 centimeters in size, as far as I know. And there are different colors on the map saying that, oh, this is an active satellite, this is an inactive satellite. And then the most of it is unidentified objects. So I would imagine that if a country sends something military up, military grade satellite, we wouldn't know much about it. So that would we can still track it because we can see that there's something up there, but we wouldn't know, you know, when it's going to come down, what it is doing. Do we necessarily know the exact orbit? So these are hard questions. So my last question, or last topic I would like to cover is the future of the space industry. How do you see Is it worth investing in? Is it worth studying to get into the space industry? What can you say about the future?
Yes. We're just going to say yes.
Okay.
I think the space sector is growing faster than any sector I've been a part of before.
Sure.
It's getting much wider as well, which is both great and a problem, because in the space sector, we tend to rely very heavily on people joining the space sector because they love space and they're interested in space. And then maybe not putting that much effort into making sure that the working hours are convenient and that we give good holidays and that we pay very well. So I think the space sector is super exciting, and I think there's a lot of people who want to join it, but I think we also need the very standard, you know, administrators, we need IT support, we need all of those kind of things that we're maybe not catering too well for at the moment. But it doesn't mean there's a lot of gaps. There, I think in the space sector, one thing we constantly hear from industry is that they just can't find the right people. You know, we need people from other sectors to decide to join the space sector and to decide to join us. But it's definitely very, very exciting. And I think there's just the reason why I joined was because when I finished my aeronautical engineering degree, I saw the future. I saw a glimpse of like what's going to happen. And I saw that I was going to spend the rest of my life optimizing the shape of a wing, you know, to eventually, hopefully, save a kilogram of fuel, which would make me a millionaire. You know, that was like the future. And now it's, you know, every single project you work on is like, you know, some aspect of it has never been done before. Mm. We're sending these satellites into the worst place ever. Space is not a place you want to be. It is cold, there's radiation, there's debris, it's terrible.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and they still work. We can still get photos back from Pluto. We can still, you know, back to the moon. We can still send satellites up that's helping us, you know, solve the climate crisis. So I think so much scope for it, so many jobs out there. Never think that it's elitist. I think we're just very, very bad at talking about it. It's not like a space that's just, I know as a PhD student, it's not for me to say, but it's not just PhD students and like these genius people. It's everybody. We're just very, very bad at talking about space.
What's needed the most in the space industry? So what do you need, more engineers, or do you need, I don't know, designers? What's urgent?
I think there's always going to be a demand for the engineers, because at the heart of everything we do is, you know, the rockets, the satellites, you know, getting to space, designing the payloads, things like that. But I think there's a lot more draw as well for these kind of adjacent sectors. So regulation you mentioned, and I think that's going to be huge in the next few years. Anything to do with policy changes. In the UK especially, you know, we're launching our own satellites for the first time from UK soil.
Yeah.
And that involves an incredible amount when it comes to insurance and licensing and, you know, developing that whole system. Like it doesn't exist. You kind of have to create it out of nothing. So as an engineer, definitely enough engineering jobs, especially if you can do anything with software, because software engineers are gold and we have to compete with every other sector for them. So if you're a software engineer, come to us. But engineers in general as well. And then there's the other huge sector, which is operations. So ground stations, you know, being able to control the satellite. We have to babysit them so much, you know, just to make sure that they're not flying into anything or doing anything strange. So being able to do that from Earth as well.
Okay. You mentioned space being a very harsh environment. And I've been asked this question, and I want to ask you the same thing. Would you go up into space? Because my answer to that was that space is so scary. Like, it really, really scares me. And I have no desire going up there. But if I was offered the chance, to turn it down would be a very dumb thing, you know, like if someone,
it's a hard thing to say no to.
Yeah, like you have the chance to go, I think I'd have to go. What do you think? Would you go?
I would go. I've been asked this question. I have no idea why I would go. But I have this huge desire to go to space, even though, as part of an analog astronaut mission before, I found out everything that can go wrong with you in space.
All right.
I know when you first get there, you're going to be incredibly nauseous, you're going to feel hungover, all the blood is going to rush to your head because your body is pumping blood at the same speed, but it's, gravity's not there. Your eyesight will come back permanently damaged, after a few months in space. If you have any emergencies up there, you have to perform stuff on yourself, which especially for dental emergencies does not sound great. I think we went through administrating anesthetic to yourself in your mouth, and being able to kill yourself as well because the nerve where you have to insert it is very close to another nerve that might end up ending your life. So it is terrifying, and yet I really, really want to go. It looks amazing. It's just that the whole thing that every astronaut comes back with saying, completely changed their view of Earth and just being able to see it from such a distance. And after the zero-G flights as well, floating is very fun. You want to be able to just float in space.
Astronauts are very carefully selected, though. I had the chance to speak to a few of them. I'm sure you've met some as well, and they were all the same, like very calm, psychologically seemingly very stable people. I've never seen people like them before. So I think they're amazing people, and we need more of those on Earth as well.
Yeah, no, definitely. But if you think about it, they're just they're like the crème de la crème, like they're the top of the top. Because in the last session, there was what 20, 22,000, 23,000 people who applied for the last set of ESA astronauts, and then there's only a handful, a dozen, So it's really the top brass people that we have that are going into space.
Definitely. Okay, well, thank you very much for talking to us, and I'm looking forward to meeting you in Manchester at the NSSC 23, and whoever wants to come along, hopefully they will come along. And I wish you all the best, and please clean up space for us.
I'll try. Thank you.
You.
Thank you for listening, and join us next time for more.